The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on March 1, 2026. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning. Nice to see you all here. You know, it was not that long ago, it was this June actually, I needed to fill in for somebody who couldn't give a talk. And so I kind of went through my old talks because I had a day to put it together, you know, and I thought, okay, I think I've got something here. And on my way to the Zendo on Sunday, I realized that the U.S. and Israel had bombed Iran, and I thought, well, we'll talk about that instead. You know, so, and yet here we are, and we find ourselves in a very similar situation. And I just want to bring your attention back to the fact that what we're looking at there are people acting out of dukkha. Right? Dukkha is that deep, deep unease in our heart, that unrest, that sense that something is off in the world, that the world, you know, talking about this word earlier this morning in our Chosan, in our little study group on Sunday morning, the perfection of the world. And the perfection of the world is in all of its messy imperfection, right? But we resist that. And we try to correct that, and we do things, we act out of dukkha. So what we're seeing right now is just actions out of dukkha, out of translation of that is often suffering. And can we see the suffering in what's going on? And I think we can. From one hand, we probably go, oh yeah, easily. These people are suffering. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about suffering. I'm talking about dukkha. I'm talking about that misapprehension that we have of the world, how we hang on to a one-sided view. And that's our interpretation of what's going on and then act from it. Now, we can look at what was happening in the Twin Cities recently. We can look, if we follow the news, if we listen to it or watch it on TV or read the news, you can encounter this over and over again. If we start to pay attention, if we start to get in tune with this, we can start to see this is all around us. Dukkha informs a lot of human activity. So it's not necessarily in these big events. Right there it is. And there you can't turn away from it. But it's also in just the little things that show up in our lives. Being irritated on the highway. You know what I mean? Going to a coffee shop and not enjoying the cup of coffee very much. You know, whatever it is, but it'll show up that way. You know, or really having fun with something and wishing it was still going on. You know, wishing it was still happening, even though it had to end. Or breaking your favorite, I don't know what it is. Now, what happened to me recently was, speaking of, and here it is again, last summer around the same time, my car started not behaving properly. I'll just put it that way. It wasn't burning fuel properly. So what happens then is the car just doesn't want to drive anymore, and actually you're not supposed to drive your car because you'll do some damage. So you pull over to the side of the car and call, you know, called my garage at that time. But it was doing that then, and guess what happened last week? It started doing it again, to the point where the garage basically, they didn't tell me this. But when they told me how much it would cost to repair it, I said, in other words, buy a new car, you know? So that kind of thing, you know, it's we can respond to that like, it's not supposed to happen. I was going to buy a new car. I really was going to buy a new car, and I thought, I'm going to do that before my car stops working, and then here it stops working, right? So that it shows up that way. Suzuki, somebody asked him once, how do wars start? And Suzuki saw two of these mats, you know, these little mats that we sit on, and they're butting against one another, and one of the mats is just a little over the top of the other. He said, that's how war starts, right there, right? So my talk today, I am going to give you the talk I prepared because I think it actually ties in to what I'm talking about. But I want to make clear that I think it's wonderful that we've all gathered today. Do you know what I mean? Because it really is essential in times like this for us to engage in this practice and to take up these studies. I think it's essential. I don't think it's a luxury. I think it's essential. So my talk today is titled Wisdom and Compassion. So wisdom and compassion are frequently seen as two distinct things. They're two different things. You've got wisdom, which is about insight and understanding into the true nature of reality. Then you've got compassion, which is about how we behave and treat one another. And that's how people see these. They're two separate things, and you got to work on each one. Why do you got to work on each one? Because, to get back to what I kind of hinted at before, because we see ourselves as imperfect, and we got to make ourselves perfect, so we have to have some true understanding, you know, whatever it is. We'll have reasons for it. We don't have to have reasons to do this, but we'll do it. So then we think, oh, I got to work on my wisdom. So I got to do some sitting, get some insight going on here. I got to read the Heart Sutra again, which I'll be talking about later in my talk, because I got to get some wisdom, right? So we'll work on that, and then we think, and now I've done that. I've worked on the wisdom part. Now I got to work on how to behave around others, how to take care of others better. And we see those two as being separate. But it just seems to me that if we look closely, we will notice that they're really not distinct, right? They're actually just two, you'd say, inflections or two variations of the same thing. That's what it strikes me. If we really look at wisdom, compassion, and what we're talking about, they're just two inflections or two variations of the same thing. That's why I think the Heart Sutra, which I've just referred to, why it opens with the character of Avalokiteshvara. So the Heart Sutra is one of the great wisdom sutras of the Mahayana tradition. It is the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the perfection, the great perfection of wisdom. Heart Sutra, the heart of the perfection of wisdom. That's that sutra. That's what it is. And if you've ever read it, you know it's condensed, man. It's 32 lines. And that's it. It's just right there. You know, it's the real deal, right? But Avalokiteshvara opens this. And Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion. So the figure who opens the great sutra of Mahayana wisdom is the bodhisattva of compassion. And what does the bodhisattva of compassion do? Well, Avalokiteshvara, when practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom, and that's meditation, was sitting in meditation, practicing deeply. We don't have to say sitting in meditation, but engaging in meditation, right? Fully living out this here now reality, right? When practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom, perceive that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. And the five skandhas are what we think of as the self. So saw that those five skandhas are empty of substance and so was saved from all suffering and distress. So that's what Avalokiteshvara does. Right at the beginning of the sutra has this penetrating insight. And then what's really interesting is the next thing that Avalokiteshvara does, which is a great act of compassion, Avalokiteshvara turns to another disciple, Shariputra. And Shariputra was considered to have been a Buddha's disciples, like the foremost disciple of wisdom. Like Shariputra was the person you turn to for questions on wisdom. And Shariputra Avalokiteshvara starts to share with Shariputra the insight that he had. Very compassionate. So, just at the beginning of that sutra, We have a teaching that helps us to see that wisdom and compassion are not distinct. They come hand to hand. Now, I'm saying this not as somebody who's trying, like, wants to get an argument that, well, compassion really is this and wisdom really is. I'm not speaking of this as a theologian who's trying to nail down some terms. You know, I don't really have any interest in that. I'm saying this as a practical matter. What is our practice? What is it to practice compassion in the world? What is that? What is it to, you know, to meditate? What is it to take up these studies? So, looking at wisdom. Wisdom, it seems to me that wisdom is seeing how everything is interdependent. Wisdom is seeing how everything is interdependent. Ultimately, there are no things that are separate from one another. Looks like it, you know. And in fact, I would not deny that things are also separate from one another. Right? It would be in error to say that things aren't also separate from one another. But they're not. That's not the whole story. And this you can actually see when you just kind of, let me say, settle into this. When you slow down. I remember my husband had read a book a number of years ago, completely different context. I can't tell you what the book is about. I just know that I like the title. It was called Slowing Down to the Speed of Life. You know, if we can slow down and really pay attention, we can see that even though, yeah, there's separation, I'm not. And what is your name?
Matthew.
Matthew?
Maggie.
It's Maggie. Maggie? Yeah. I'm not you, and you're not me. Right, so we know that there is some separation there, but if we start to really look, we can start to see how that separation isn't ultimate. It's not ultimately what's going on here, which is the way that we tend to put things together. And you can do that just with any simple thing. You can see how that's true. So, for example, I just hold up this sheet of paper, and at the dumbest level, and this is something that all I got to say is, I know that as a Zen teacher, I say a lot of very obvious things. But I feel like I do because reality is clear and obvious. It is not hidden and obscured. It's clear and obvious, and we always overlook it. So if I sound like I'm a child, so be it. But here's a sheet of paper. And this sheet of paper can appear here because it's not something else. Because it's not Brian here. It's not the clock here. It's not the wall here. Right? It's because everything else is not here that this can show up here. And that's just one way we can see that this is not separate from everything else. So in other words, for this to be here, everything else has to not be here. So everything else is already here at this sheet of paper showing up here. And then, with wisdom, something that those who've been taking our foundation classes here at Dharma Field have heard, when we perceive with right wisdom, right, we do not see things as they are, we see things as they have come to be. As they have come to be. So not as they are, but as they have come to be. So we see this sheet of paper, and we know it's not separate from, and then here we go. You know, I lived in a part of Wisconsin that was a big paper milling part of the state. So I know a little bit about that because I actually worked at a paper mill for a few months in a summer. And it was... there are different kinds of paper mills. I'm not going to bore you with all of that. But one of the things that this did is it actually pulped paper, and not all paper mills do that. So they get logs coming in, and then they'd pulp those logs, and they'd turn them into paper. And I worked in a room that would take the slurry that was like the, whatever you want to call that, the pulp, And then they'd run it through these machines. The first thing they'd do is they'd slap this stuff onto like a bed of felt, and it would absorb water. And then they would shoot the stuff into these giant iron drums that would dry it out. And by the end of about a city block of these hot iron drums, you'd have sheets of paper. You know, not sheets of paper. There'd be, well, it was a sheet, but it was, you know, miles long. I don't know how long those things were, but it was a really long sheet of paper. But come shooting out of this thing, right? So I know that. That whole process is involved with this. So I know there are trees here. I know that there's turning, you know, cutting the trees up and then turning the trees into pulp and then turning the pulp into paper. And that involves all this other stuff, all that steel and all that energy. And, you know, where did the steel come from? Well, the steel came from, you know, iron ore. And it had to be pulled out of the ground by people. And so you got all these people that are involved. It's very easy to start seeing that this sheet of paper is not just this sheet of paper. That all of that, and if you keep looking, the deal with things is they're endless. If you keep looking, it is just boundless. It is going to include the entire universe. So in another way of looking at it, the entire universe is showing up right here as this piece of paper. And that's how we realize that things ultimately aren't separate from one another. And that insight, it seems to me, affects our response to the world. If you really have that insight, you know, something can be right there, and I don't know, something can irk you, something can bug you, something, you know, something somebody's doing. But if we can see it, see that all things are showing up as that activity, and it might be something we really don't like, but we can at least see it differently rather than maybe want to extinguish it. There might be a different way that we have of approaching that person who's engaging in that behavior, because we can see it from a different perspective. And if you really see it clearly, you realize that you are part of what it is that you're looking at that you're uncomfortable with. You are part of that. You're inseparable from that. That is wisdom. That is seeing the interdependence of everything. Everything is constantly changing in a dance. The big dance. Cosmic dance. It's constantly going on and is showing up as this experience, as this. So wisdom is seeing how everything is interdependent. Compassion is seeing how we think otherwise. So wisdom is seeing how everything is interdependent. Compassion is seeing how we think otherwise. We think otherwise. We don't see this world as being interdependent. We see this world as being made up of all these separate individual things. And one of those separate individual things is me. And I'm going through this world alone. I'm going through this life alone. And each moment, I inch just a little bit closer to oblivion. Right? So, or if you have some kind of idea of an afterlife, at least toward death. Every moment I inch toward that. And in that particular perspective, when we just see ourselves as completely isolated like this, you can see how this is easy to do. It all becomes about me. It's all about me. Ask yourself. Just watch. You don't even have to ask yourself. Just watch. Watch how easily your experience has turned into how this is affecting me. You know, this is about me. I mean, I can't tell you, it was taking up this practice they started to actually notice that when something was going to come out of my mouth, you know, even if I was going to express what I thought, express compassion, what I thought was compassion to another person, somebody who I saw was suffering, in my head it was being formulated in how this was affecting me. But I couldn't even believe it. I was just like, oh, okay, I guess I don't need to say that. Do you know what I mean? Because that's really about me. That has nothing to do with the situation. Maybe better at this moment not to say anything at all. Just be here. But yeah, when we overlook how everything is interdependent, right, it just becomes all about me. And then you can start to see that when pain arises, now it's my pain. So there's me, and then there's my pain. Like a little vaudeville act, me and my pain, right? And then you can do what with your pain? Well, because it's separate from you, now you can, well, first of all, you might blame something for it. I wouldn't be feeling this pain if it wasn't for that thing. And we do that a lot. We kind of look around, what's the cause of this? I know I do that a lot. You go, why am I feeling like this? Because it doesn't feel good. You know, so you try to locate it, and then you go, okay, it's out there. That thing made me feel like this. And then we might do something to that thing we think is the cause. And it might not be such a great thing that we're doing. But regardless, when we see the pain is separate from us, what we want to do is just be rid of it. Perhaps by any means necessary. So, that compassion then is to see how we do that. How we do what I just described. So, if wisdom is seeing everything is interdependent, compassion is seeing how we think otherwise. It's to understand that. So it's to actually hear or see the dukkha in a lot of human activity. But seeing, if we think about wisdom, link between compassion and wisdom, if we look at wisdom, we need to see interdependency, right? To see how we overlook it. And if we look at compassion, we need to see how our grasping at separation is at the root of our suffering because we're overlooking this interdependency of all things. So I thought I would share with you a koan about this, about compassion. And I partly did this because of all of the, you know, flavors of Buddhism, the one that I think kind of gets a bad rap on the compassion front is Zen, actually. And I think Zen is often seen as being detached or emotionless, somewhat intellectual, cool. And I thought, well, what is the best example of all of that other than the Zen koan, which are those stories that seem like these baffling, weird, you know. I used to read them when I first started sitting Zen to laugh because they didn't make any sense to me. It'd be like a guy would say, where are the geese? And the other guy would say, what do you mean, where are the, I don't know, where, I don't, what do you mean, where are the geese? And then a guy put something on his head and turn around and bark or something, and then it would say, and then he was enlightened, and he'd just be like, well, I don't understand this at all. So I used to read these things. They made that much sense to me. Do you know what I mean? I'd read them, and they just seemed like a bunch of nonsense. And so I'd read them, and I'd start laughing, and I'd share them with my husband, and I'd go, listen to this one, you know what I mean? It just doesn't make any sense. So I just thought, that, what a perfect thing. So I thought I would go online and just type koan compassion, because I just off the top of my head, I couldn't think of anything. And I'm only telling you this because I did find a koan that I've never heard of that I remember. I don't remember ever encountering this before. And I found it in all kinds of places on the internet, one of which was Reddit. And I always, whenever I see things on Reddit, I kind of go, okay, who knows if this is real or not. So I was trying to find the source for this koan. And I spent a lot of time when I should have been working on my talk actually trying to find out where this came from. I was not successful. And so I debated. Because it actually reminded me of another koan that I do know is a real koan. So I just thought, well, do I go with the one I encountered on Reddit or do I go with the one that I know is a real koan? I thought I'd go with the Reddit one because I like it. It's a good koan. So even if some guy just made it up, he did a pretty good job. That's a pretty good call. And it features one of the great Zen masters of all time, Joshu. Joshu was a Zen master. He lived through pretty much the entirety of the 9th century in China. But he was actually born a couple decades before that, so let that sink in. He was 9th century. He studied with a master. It was granted Dharma transmission at some point in his studies, but continued to study with his master. Because Joshu understood that this is a practice, I'll touch on this again in a moment, but he understood this is not a practice you're ever done with. Right? Life is always something that we're engaging with, we're always, we could say, learning from this. So Joshu just kept studying with his teacher until his teacher passed away, and Joshu was already 40 years old. This is in 9th century China, so I'm guessing that made him not a spring chicken anymore, do you know what I mean? And then at 40 years old, he became a wandering monk. And he wandered for 40 years. Now, I don't know if this is true. This is just the story about Joshu, right? So now he's 80 years old, and he finally settles down to lead a monastery at the age of 80, and then taught his students for another 40 years. So for 120 years. He was a very gifted teacher. And that's why I thought I would do this, because he was a gifted teacher, and this seems to be in order with his teachings, right? So, it's a short koan. One day, Zen Master Joshu lay in the snow, calling out, "Help me! Please help me!" A monk came and lay beside him. Joshu stood up and left. That's the koan. And I told you, it can be like that. You go, what? What was that? So again, one day Zen Master Joshu lay in the snow calling out, "Help me, please help me." A monk came and lay beside him. Joshu stood up and left. And this is the koan that came up as a koan about compassion. And I remember when I read it, I went, well, I know it seems kind of crazy, but I get that. I see the compassion. I don't know if you can picture this. Joshua, I don't know how old he was, but we know he was, could have been between the ages of 40 and 80 probably at this point, right? Laying in the snow, "Help me," and somebody goes and lies next to him. It's very touching. I can't even really put my finger on it. But there seems to be an awareness of non-separation that's being expressed in that action. You know, Joshu's not any different from this monk. He might be laying in the snow, but... And that suffering, perhaps, that Joshu is going through, the monk, whatever it is, the monk is showing this experience is the same. And that was good enough for Joshu, right? Who knows what Joshu was doing at this point? Though it is interesting to know Joshu was a master, and this was a monk, so there probably was recognition between them. So the monk probably didn't go around and whenever he saw somebody lying on the ground, just laid next to them. You know, he probably understood this as an opportunity to express his understanding. And Joshu didn't press the matter any further. Really, if you think about what the monk is expressing in his action, is that he realizes that when I suffer alone, right, when that is what's showing up, that's when there's real suffering. That's when we hang on, to the suffering. That's when we make something out of it. And then we want to get rid of it, right? So the monk seemed to understand that, right? That suffering and that sense of being alone, they go hand in hand. The monk shows him he's not alone. This isn't really how it works, though in another way we are ultimately, if all beings are interdependent, in a way you'll sometimes hear this is, then all is one, right? But in a way it's true, but it's not a one the way we think of one, as being one as opposed to nothing, or one as opposed to two. In fact, the better teaching is not one, not two, as an expression of what it is that's showing up. And so what this monk does is he realizes, please help me. How do we help those who are suffering in this world? And it's not the action that the monk takes. This is one of the problems I think sometimes we have in koans. We read it and then the guys seem to be doing strange stuff. And then you go, so wait a minute, I'm supposed to do that? I'm supposed to lie down? When it's not about really the action itself. It's about the intention behind the action. And so when the monk lies down, right, you think about Avalokiteshvara, the beginning of the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara has this insight. What does Avalokiteshvara do? He shares it. This monk has this insight into the fact that we're not separate, we're not alone, right? He has this insight and he shares it with Joshu. That's what he does. That's helping Joshu. When we act, right, whatever we do could be right, could be wrong. It's the nature of actions, right? It could be left, it could be right. It could be good, it could be bad. All of this stuff, even though it's a little hard for us to wrap our heads around, all of this stuff is relative anyhow. Left in relative to what? Right in relative, you know, in relation to what? It's always got to be in relation to some particular thing. Good in relation to what? Bad in relation to what? Where does it start? Where does it end? How do we really define those terms? Right or wrong? What are we talking about? Very provisional. So it's not those, you know, it's not the action itself, but it's the intention behind it. What are we intending to do when we act? Is it to, well, we'll be reciting our bodhisattva vows here in just a minute, right? Is it to save all sentient beings? Is it for the whole that we're acting? Or is it out of some idea we have that we're clinging to, that one-sided view that when we cling to that, there's confusion. We overlook wisdom. So, right intention, acting not with the intention to serve ourself, not out of the world of choices and preferences, which, by the way, is the world we live in. So do we continually make choices based on preferences and ideas? Of course we do. That's this world we live in. But do we just buy into our preferences and our ideas? Or can we see them for what they are, which is just our preferences and our ideas? And to see that is then to perhaps act with right intention, to see what our intention is. Right intention drives appropriate action. And all I mean by that is whatever you do is appropriate. You know what I mean? But it needs to come from right intention. It's not that whatever you do is appropriate. Because sometimes what we do is very inappropriate, and we know that. We can see the harm it's causing. But that intention is important. When we sit Zazen, when we sit our meditation, we sit with right intention. That's Zazen. Without right intention, it's not Zazen. Where is it? Right? Where does Zazen start? And where does it end? Our Bodhisattva vows, as I said, the first thing we say is to save all sentient beings, though they are numberless. Numberless! Think about that. Where does numberless begin? Where does it end? We're never done. We never get to say, great, I saved all sentient beings. We just don't get to say it. It has no beginning and no end. It's always now. Now is where we do it. And if we pay attention, it's always now. Not the present moment. It's always now. It shows up as a present moment. But where is the present moment? The present moment, you can't grab a hold of that. That is now. And to realize that is to, that's zazen. To realize that is wisdom. And to realize that is compassion. So, those are my comments today. I don't know if people have things they want to share, just things that are on their mind right now, questions that you might have. Feel free.
I don't think this was like the heart of your talk, but something that struck me was when you said you like reading koans early in your practice, like not landing at all. And it sounds like now they do mean something to you. Or like I always feel so glad I'm in Soto Zen where we don't do koan practice, because I like almost hate them when I read them, because I don't, it doesn't make any sense, which I know is the point, but it's not. It's just like really not landing for me. Yep. So I'm curious, I don't know if you could say more about where that transition happened or how you, you probably can't explain it, which is the point.
Let me ask you this. Is the kind of sort of off-putting nature of them, does it have to do with their sort of seeming cryptic quality or their insularity? What seems like they're sort of self-contained or whatever?
Yeah. It's hard to say why I have such a strong reaction to it, because other sort of inarticulate parts of Zen I do like mean so much, but it feels like a trick they're playing on me that I don't like.
Yeah, I would say because at the beginning, this is sort of like when I was first really starting to look at art, you know, art like painting it was, and I would see paintings by Picasso. And they were late paintings by Picasso. So they were very, you know, like bold lines. And you know, they almost look like children's drawings in a way. And I would look at them and I'd say, that's art? You know? But there was something that intrigued me about it. Because I just went, well, he's Picasso. Everybody knows who Picasso is. Picasso's a great artist, you know? So I actually... That intrigued me, you know, that Picasso was supposed to be great, but I would look at it and it didn't look particularly great to me, you know. So I kind of dug into it, into what Picasso was up to, and started to gain appreciation. So with the Zen koans, something like that, that just seems so utterly ridiculous and incomprehensible, I just feel like there's got to be something here. So I just kept reading them. And yeah, and then I can't tell you, there wasn't like a moment where one just suddenly, you know, change, but I started reading them differently. And I think one of the things that I did, and I still do this, by the way, but I started realizing that when I was reading them, they seemed impenetrable. I was trying to interpret them. You know what I mean? I was trying to figure them out. And then they seemed like little, you know, impenetrable rocks. Do you know what I mean? I was like, I can't figure this out. I'll say I just went to see a play at the Walker Art Center on Friday night. Oh, the Symphony of Rats. Did you go to Symphony of Rats? I had told her about this earlier in the year. So I said, if you got to see anything this year, you got to see Symphony of Rats. And I'm probably glad you didn't go see it. Not that it was bad, but it was one of these aesthetic experiences that I have every once in a while because of the kind of stuff I like. I will have this experience. And so I'm watching this play, and I'm kind of going, what in the name of, you know, Sam Hill, or Sam Scratch, I don't know how that goes. What are they talking about? I don't understand this play at all. You know, and I was trying to go, okay, the guy's supposed to be the president, but he's in a spaceship, or he's not in a spaceship, but there's a magic box back there. And at some point I just went, okay, I give up. I'm going to stop trying to figure this out and just enjoy the show, because there was a lot to enjoy about it. And you know what? It was a fun show then. But up until that point, I was trying to figure it out, and it was really not helping anything. You know what I mean? I wasn't figuring it out. And I think koans were kind of like that too. I started to see how my attempt to really rationally figure out what was going on was actually getting in my way of appreciating the koan and even kind of seeing what it was helping me to see, which sometimes is only, though the koan might have been pointing to something else, it was helping me to see how I was trying to make sense out of it. And that helped me to see how I do that in life all the time, where I'm trying to make rational sense out of a world that we were talking about earlier today, you know, that the world is just, it's, for lack of a better, you know, better way to put it, it's goofy, you know. So there's the way we think the world should look, and it's it might be pretty rational, it might not be rational, but there's a way that it looks, and then there's an element to it that seems like it doesn't belong there. And the author of the book we were looking at, she was at Shinryu Suzuki's memorial service. And she was talking about how solemn and beautiful this memorial service was. And then there was this one guy, and he had like kind of a smirk on his face, and he seemed kind of aloof from the whole thing. And it really bugged her. She's going, what? But this is a really solemn moment. It was so beautiful. And then there's that guy over there just smirking away, and he doesn't really belong here. And she kind of noticed she was doing that. She was trying to reject what was going on and saying, this is the way it should be. It shouldn't be like this. And then when she opened herself up to the fact that that is how this moment was showing up, then she realized that's how this is. That's right now. It includes that guy smiling, right? And reality is like that. It includes elements. So I talked about, when I see if I can get that falsetto again, my voice has sunk so much over the years. But I talked about something that I saw that I remember kind of going, this isn't something you would expect, but this is exactly the way it is, for lack of a better term. And that was, I worked at a hospital, and I worked with a guy who had, I don't know what condition he had, you know, but it was something like Tourette's. He wasn't saying like filthy things or anything like that, but he really needed to like make a lot of noise. You know, sometimes he would do like TV, like you know how TV networks used to have, like they kind of do almost a rundown of what was going to be on TV that night, and they go, tonight on Gunsmoke, and then they'd have, well, that's what this guy would do as he was delivering charts around the hospital. He'd go, tonight on Gunsmoke, and then he'd do this little thing, and he'd do gunshots, and you know, and he was just doing this kind of stuff all day long, and he couldn't help himself. So he was sitting in the lobby of the hospital. And, you know, as I pointed out earlier, this is sort of a decorum that you associate with, you know, being in the waiting room of a hospital. And he had a newspaper, and it was the local gay newspaper, and he had it held out at arm's length. Oh, you have to know what this guy looked like. He was tall, large-framed guy, had a buzz cut, and then he had these bright eyes. He would just always be like, ooh, you know, and he had this newspaper out at arm's length, and he would be like, ooh, 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 ooh. And I thought, that's really weird. And it's exactly what this should be. Do you know what I mean? Like, it really dawned on me that as weird and out of place as that seemed, it was exactly what was going on. You know, it was exactly this world. And I started thinking about somebody like the filmmaker David Lynch, you know, I just don't remember this movie Blue Velvet, where a guy was walking his dog, and he was just this guy, and he was just standing. He was just standing, and there was a dog on a leash, and he was just standing, and the characters walked past him, and you don't really know what the guy's doing there. He doesn't seem to be doing anything but just standing there with the dog. The dog's not doing anything. The guy's not doing anything. They're just standing. And it's very weird, and it kind of unsettles you a bit because you're going, why is that guy standing there? Then you go out in the world and start noticing. Why is that guy standing there? You know what I mean? Like, this is how the world is. So getting back to koans. There is that aspect of reality that you just can't rationally package up and understand. And so sometimes I would realize, if nothing else while I was reading the koan, that I was trying to do that. And then really, I found it to be helpful that how often I'd pick a koan up and start going, wait a minute, what? Why did this guy do this? Why did he say this? You know? And I would just notice that would be almost my go-to thing, you know. And then again, like I said, I started realizing that's kind of how I approach the world. Is I'm always trying to figure it out. I'm a pretty stupid person, so there's a lot of stuff I don't know that I'm trying to figure out what's going on that I don't really, you know, can't bring to bear on the situation. So I don't know if that helped you, but
Oh my gosh, it gave me a lot to think about, yeah. And it's interesting in a good way. I mean, I love David Lynch movies, and with those, I feel like the presence of something more in the thing that doesn't make sense, and I don't feel that with Coens in the same way. I like the idea that, like, oh, it was just practice that brought you into it. Yeah. Just reading, not understanding it, and reading and reading, and it did. It clicked, and I was thinking it, like, invites you to engage, and I think that's where I have the, like, I don't like this, and trying to imagine what I would say back that wasn't not performative, but how is it not performative if it doesn't make any sense to me, so what would I have
absolutely.
To say? Yeah.
Yeah, and when I think about it in relation to the talk I was giving today, you know, that response that I have to koans, that response that we can have with the world, is to have compassion with the world when it shows up, you know, in ways that we don't want it to show up, when it seems forbidden or forbidding, you know. Good. That was a great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else on people's minds? Probably too much. All right. Yeah, Kaylee.
Question from Denny online.
From?
Denny.
Oh, Denny. Go ahead, Denny.
Morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
In relation to your talk, would you just say a good practical way to be compassionate and just have wisdom in your everyday life would be to, you know, kind of have unwilled action by just not making it about your little self? Like, is that a good way to approach being a good person, basically, you know, to be compassionate and have wisdom, like I believe all of us would like to be. And that's part of the reason why I practice. Would you say a simple way in my little brain to think about it would be just don't make it about yourself. Just, is that part of the, like, would you recommend practicing that way? Like, I know when we meditate, the teaching always says, just look at your thoughts, let them go, basically. But I guess my question is, in this point in my practice, I'm probably overthinking everything, but my main thing that I find myself thinking about is, okay, I'm thinking about myself, I'm making it about myself, don't do that. I'm kind of, dwelling on that maybe. So is that something you think about in your practice a lot? Like you catch yourself, your thoughts or whatnot, thinking about yourself and making it about yourself. And if you don't do that, you'll be more compassionate and have more wisdom. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. And let me say that first of all, to answer part of your question, you know, do you find yourself thinking about yourself? Oh yeah, all the time. And it may show up as, well, I'm thinking about myself. Look at that, you know. We do it. But to your broader question, yeah, I think it's easy to overthink this, right? And so thinking, well, you know, you were saying, Denny, that you noticed that you're thinking about yourself, and then you tell yourself, well, I shouldn't be, well, however you term it, you know, I shouldn't be thinking about myself, or I am now going to do something that's not thinking about myself. When you think about all of that, it's still really rooted in thinking about yourself, you know, is thinking about yourself, and thinking about yourself, not thinking about yourself. So the easiest way to do it, Denny, is when you catch yourself doing that, it's all about me routine. Then, just return your attention to this this. Right? So part of this, you know, what you just saw was the thing, the object of mind that you were hanging onto. Right? That's the thing you were gripping hold of. So now you realize, oh, I'm gripping hold of that. So now you realize that's what this is. When you realize that's what this is, your attention broadens almost immediately because you lose that thing you thought you have, you realize you don't really have it. It just opens up. And so that's all I would say is just it's returning to here now. That's it. That's what our meditation practice is, when you realize that you've been gripped by object of mind, and the way that shows up for us when we sit meditation is daydreaming or maybe drowsing or something, you know, something that's right there. And when we daydream, we might be thinking about having a conversation with somebody. Maybe we run through a lot of the conversation. I was talking with somebody recently, and he was saying, yeah, before I met with you, I had this conversation with you probably about 100 times, you know. And I was like, yeah, I've done that, you know. And I will say, I've not only done that, but I've done that, like, out loud. When I don't think anyone else is around, then I'm having this conversation with this person that I'm not having a conversation with, you know. And so when we're doing that, to realize you're doing that, to realize that you're engaging that, is usually just to, if you realize you're running around your house talking to somebody that's not there, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? You just stop. You just kind of go, and that's it. So, yeah, it's simpler, Denny. It's just return your attention. And right now, we pay attention to our breath. That's always there. So when you see that you're lost in thought, just bring your attention back. And your breath's right here, so bring your attention back to your breath. That'll bring you right back to this until you spin out again. But yeah, if the way it shows up is, I'm thinking about myself, I'm going to stop thinking about myself. Nope, I'm still not thinking about myself. Whatever it is, it becomes an eddy, and you just kind of keep spinning out. So hopefully that's
basically
helpful.
No, that was very helpful. Basically, just another simple way of putting it maybe is just like, you know, the 12-fold chain, just don't ignore the reality of this moment just now, like you said earlier in your talk. And then usually if you're in the now, then I guess you're not thinking about yourself.
That's right. All right. Once you make it, I'm not thinking about myself, then it's about yourself. But when it's just opening up to what is now, what this is, then you're not thinking about yourself, right? Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Thank you.
And you can see the compassion in that. Again, this is compassion and wisdom, right? Just coming back to now, nothing laid on top of it, open to it, and that takes us out of ourself and opens us up to what is. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.